Well, hey, you know, it's interesting because so many times when we get to places where we don't know how to deal with something, maybe we're dealing with people problems, maybe we're dealing with something that we're trying to solve, so many times we hold out for a hero. And there's certainly times where heroes can come and they can save the day. But one of the things I want to look at today is how maybe some of the things that we deal with day in, day out, some of the things that we are in need of change of are right here within our midst. We just are not able to see them. And so I want to dive into this morning. My name's Kurt again, by the way. If you just walked in or if you're listening on the podcast, it's great to see you this morning. And it's great to be back with you. As I said a few minutes ago, I've been listening along through the Spark series. It's been fantastic. I've enjoyed it. I think there's been something for every single one of us throughout this series. And if you're new here today or you're new over the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, you know, one of the reasons that I've been away for 4 weeks is this really cool thing our leadership does for me and my family where they require me. I mean, it's like people are like, oh, they require you to take a month off. It's a lot of work to be off for a month, in case you haven't ever done that. It takes a lot of planning. But I mean, we're so appreciative. They require us to take a month off, in addition to some of the other vacation we get during the year, to just recharge the batteries. And it's, you know, our leadership values fresh leaders, and so it's just an absolute blessing to my family, for us to just have some downtime. But it's also really a time for us to kind of be able to you know, re-engage with what God's doing in our lives in a way when we don't have all the busyness going on. And there's a lot of self-discovery that comes out of that, and so I'm gonna share a little bit out of that today. But it's also good for Crosspoint because, you know, you hear from different voices during this month, voices you don't necessarily hear from the rest of the year, and there's a really healthy thing as we hear from others. So man, just super excited about that time, and it's just great to be back with you as well. So today I want to talk about this thing that I've been learning over the past few weeks, really. I mean, really, it's just been the last 2 weeks. It's really been a game changer for me. And it started with a book, which I'm going to share with you this morning. But I just believe it has the potential to really move the needle for every single one of us. If you're dealing with something that you would kind of say is a people problem, whether that's in the team that you lead at work or the team you're a part of, or if it's in your marriage or with your kids or, you know, something with neighbors, any kind of relational, you know, people problem, I just think that what we talk about today may really apply to where you're at. Jesus said something once in Luke chapter 6, verse 31. He said, "Treat others the same way you want them to treat you." Now, we've heard this, right? I mean, many of us know this is the golden rule. This verse is really about mutual respect. It's about self-awareness. It's about other awareness. But like, how do you do that? How do you treat others the same way you want them to treat you in business? I mean, when you're you know, trying to go in for a sale and you've kind of got a clear thing you're trying to accomplish, how do you be so mindful of what the other person needs and wants that you treat them in the same way that you would want them to treat you? How do you do that in your family context? How do you do that with your neighbors when, you know, you want things a certain way and yet they have different expectations? Like, how do you treat them the same way that you would want them to treat you? It's something Jesus calls us to do. And so this is why I'm super excited about today, because see, here's the thing. I don't know all of you. In fact, I don't know many of you, but here's what I know about every single one of you. And that is that you've got a problem. All right, you've got a problem that you're going to have to figure out how to solve. And the crazy thing is the people that you work with know you have this problem. And if you're married, your spouse or your partner knows you have this problem. And heck, your mother-in-law probably knows you have this problem. Your neighbors certainly know you have this problem. But oftentimes you don't know that you have this problem. And of course, you probably think, well, how do I get to the bottom of something that I don't know that I have? And so this is what we're going to talk about today. And so I want to kind of give you an illustration before we get into this, an illustration from the world of medicine that's kind of an analogous example. And so how many of you have ever heard of Ignat Semmelweis? Semmelweis, that's my best German right there. Ignat, anybody heard of Ignat? Any medical personnel studied in anybody? Nobody? I don't see any hands. All right. Well, Ignat Semmelweis, he was a European doctor, practiced in the mid-1800s, and he practiced at this hospital known as Vienna General Hospital. And he was trying to get to the bottom of this major, major problem, this horrendous mortality rate in the maternity ward that he oversaw. And so this maternity ward where Semmelweis practiced and oversaw patients, was the mortality rate was 1 in 10. All right, get this. 1 out of every 10 women that gave birth in that ward died. All right, now men, you'd probably be like, my wife is not going close to that ward, right? And rightfully so. In fact, it was so bad, and it had such a bad reputation that women would actually give birth in the the streets and alleyways outside the hospital. And then after they gave birth, they would check themselves in for the post-care. All right, it was that bad. Now, the collection of symptoms that were connected to these deaths eventually became known as childhood bed fever. And the general medical protocol at the time was just to treat the symptoms. That was typically what was done in the mid-1800s. And so, you know, if there was some kind of infection or inflammation, that usually meant that the blood, there was excess blood, and so the blood needed to be drained off from the patient, or the medical personnel would apply leeches, which is a practice back in that day, to address the infection or the inflammation. Or, for instance, if there was like a, trouble breathing, then they assumed that the ventilation was bad, so we need to increase the ventilation. And so, you know, they tried all these different things and nothing seemed to work. All right. In fact, half of the women that contracted the disease died. I mean, it was a crazy, crazy high mortality rate. In fact, Semmelweis, he was so bothered by this because he'd watch these women who would give birth and then they would contract this disease. He'd begin to see the symptoms and they would plead with the medical personnel to be transferred from that ward to the next ward in the next building because the mortality rate was not as high. It was like 1 in 50, which still is horrendous, but it wasn't like 1 in 10. And so Semmelweis, he became obsessed with trying to figure out why the mortality rate was so high in his ward, more so than the other ward. In fact, the only difference was the ward that he oversaw was overseen by physicians, and the other ward, the one that had the 50-to-1 mortality rate, was overseen by midwives. And yet that he didn't really feel like that was giving any evidence to why there was such a big difference in the rate. And so he standardized everything. He standardized everything from birthing position to, the temperature, to the ventilation, to diet, to how they washed and cleaned the bed linens. I mean, everything, but nothing seemed to make an impact. And then something happened. Semmelweis, he actually went away for 4 months, and he began to do research at another hospital to learn some of their practices. And when he returned after 4 months, he found that the mortality rate had dropped, and it drastically changed in his absence. And so again, he began to dig in to why this was, and his inquiry began to lead him to maybe thinking that the doctors in his ward, it had something to do with the cadavers that they were studying. Because, see, they were studying cadavers because this is a research and learning teaching hospital. And so he realized the doctors in his ward would split their time. About 50% of time would be done on cadavers researching, and the other 50% would be done with the patients who were giving birth. And see, that didn't really concern them at the time because they had no awareness of germs, right? Germs hadn't been discovered or there was no awareness of this. All they knew were symptoms when it came to an illness. And so when looking at the data for the patients that he had cared for, the only identifiable difference was that while he was gone, the physicians in his ward, they didn't really do any research. They just took care of patients and the mortality rate dropped. And so from his observations, he developed this theory known as childhood bed fever. And it was actually the theory that was the precursor to the germ theory that Louis Pasteur actually eventually kind of confirmed. But it was Semmelweis who concluded that the particles from the cadavers being transferred on the hands of the physicians were the things that were actually making these patients sick. And so he immediately instituted this new policy where every physician had to rinse their hands in this lime and chlorine rinse before they touched any patient. And what do you think happened? Immediately, the mortality rate fell to less than 1%, less than 1 in 100. And so he was right. Semmelweis was right. The doctors were the ones carrying the particles that were creating the deaths. I mean, who would have imagined? And in fact, Semmelweis even commented once. He said, God only knows the number of patients that went prematurely to their graves because of me. I mean, imagine living with that as a doctor. I mean, the doctors who were doing the best that they could to treat their patients, they were actually the ones carrying the disease with this multitude of symptoms, all of which could have been prevented with a single act once the common cause was identified and the symptoms were discovered. Now, why do I tell you this story? Here's why. Because there is a common germ that invades our teams and our workspaces. There's a common germ that invades our leadership, our organizations, our marriages, our relationships with our kids, with our friends. It's a germ that all of us carry to one extent or another. It's a germ that kills leadership. It neutralizes teams. It neutralizes forward progress. It's a germ that causes a multitude of what we call people problems. And yet, it can be isolated and it can be neutralized. And of course, you're going, well, what's the germ? Well, that's what we're going to get into today. Because see, there's a technical name for it. In fact, psychologists and philosophers have given it this name right here, self-deception. And kind of the less technical term is what we would call being in the box. And so I want to explain today how self-deception and being in the box really begin to influence our relationships. And as we do this, we're going to identify this germ that we all are susceptible to and how it creates, as I said, this multitude of people problems. It creates a sense of problems in leadership, problems in marriage, problems in our relationships with our adult kids, with our minor kids, adult kids with your adult parents. I mean, all of our relationships and everything in between, and it's mostly caused by the same thing. It's self-deception. Now, I recently discovered this as Julie and I were off over this last month. One of the things we did while we were away is we did some leadership assessments, which we do every couple of years, take a battery of assessments, and then we met with one of our coaches' consultants that has been a coach of mine for about 10 years. And we spent 9 hours one day kind of breaking all these assessments down. It was one of the coolest things. I mean, it's very self-revealing. And really, we do this because we want to continue to become the best version of ourselves, not only for Crosspoint, but for our family, for our friends, for life. I mean, we want to maximize what we're doing in life. And so in the midst of this, Greg, he introduced me to this book called Leadership and Self-Deception. How many of you have read or heard of Leadership and Self-Deception? Oh, only a handful of us. Awesome. All right, so if you know this, you're like, oh my word, this changes the game. For the rest of us, this book's been around for 19 years. I'm like, how have I not heard about this book? So I want to kind of dive into some of the principles of this in terms of, and what it means for us to treat others, one of these core things Jesus asks is treat others the way that we want to be treated. So to help us understand what it means to be in the box or what self-deception is, take a look at this short video right here.
Self-deception is simply the problem of not knowing I have a problem. A willful blindness to our own part in the problems we face. It's one of the primary sources of conflict in our personal lives and the underlying issue that is at the heart of most organizational problems as well. It is a problem we all have. It's like being stuck in a box. When we are self-deceived, we no longer really see what's going on. We become blind to reality. When we're in this box, we're blind to the humanity of other people. We see them as objects rather than as people with their own needs, challenges, and objectives that are equally as important as our own. Some of us might think that we are skillful enough to behave in ways that mask how we see others. The truth is, no matter what we're doing on the outside, people primarily respond to how we're feeling about them on the inside. Even if I'm nice or polite to others, if I'm in the box toward them, if I am seeing them as an object rather than the full person they are, they can sense this. So, what leads to self-deception? How do we find ourselves in this box in the first place? Well, as human beings, we have an intuitive sense of what we should do for others. We sense what might be helpful to them. Very often, however, we betray that sense and fail to do the thing we sense we should do. We call this self-betrayal. Simply put, self-betrayal is acting contrary to what I feel I should do for another person. When we betray ourselves, we begin to see the world in a way that justifies our self-betrayal. We start to create justifications for failing to see others as they are. As people, we exaggerate others' faults, inflate our own virtues, and blame others for making us feel and act the way we do. And all of this keeps us from seeing honestly our own role in creating the problems we complain about most. In this self-justifying experience we call the box, our view of reality is distorted. We no longer see things as they really are. And when we aren't seeing clearly, our solutions to problems tend to make matters worse.
All right, so think about this for just a moment. When we operate in the box, we don't see things clearly. And when we come up with solutions, we often make matters worse. See, self-deception is one of the most common causes and breakdowns in organizations, relationships, marriages, teams, all of this. And yet the biggest problem is we often can't see it. And so I want to kind of walk us through some scenarios today to help us kind of say, okay, is this something that I need to begin to pay attention to? All right, so I want to share a couple examples with you this morning that have recently played out for me. So early this summer, month of June, it was right after school got out, I landed at a Starbucks to do some teaching prep one Tuesday morning, partly because I usually do teaching prep at home. My kids had gotten out of school. Our home was busy, had all kinds of noise, kids, friends in and out of the house. I'm like, I need some space. So I went to a Starbucks. I had my computer. I had some of my resources. We were in a series called Navigating High Achiever Culture. I was listening to some podcasts, so I stuck my earbuds in. I had some books I was referencing. So I had this all laid out. The only table that was available in the Starbucks was like the long community table. You know, like all the individual tables, you know, were taken. And so there's like four seats at the end of this long, like 10-seat table. So I landed on one end and I spread everything out kind of on my end. My bag was in the chair next to me. Now, my goal, I was just trying to create some space where I could work, I could hone in. I was feeling a little pressure to make sure I was prepared, and this was changing my routine. Now, as I went throughout the morning, as I was working, I was very focused, but I would notice every now and then someone would walk by my end of the table, and I could tell by their body language that they were kind of considering one of the seats, you know, on my end of the table. So I wouldn't really look up at them. I would kind of peer out above the, you know, computer screen to see if they were, you know, looking at my seats. And then if I noticed they were, I'd like push my stuff out, you know, do a big stretch. I was trying to make my end of the table as undesirable as possible, right? Like, have you ever done this? You know what I'm saying? Like if you're on a self-selected seat flight, you know, like Southwest, and you have to pick your seat, you try to make, like, your space undesirable, right? And so this is what I was doing. I had a job. I was trying to hone in. I had something important to do. Now, I want you to think for just a moment, all right? On the surface, what's going on? What am I doing? What are the behaviors I'm engaged in? All right, what was I doing, just in a basic sense? Some of you are like, well, you were being a jerk. That's what you were being. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. All right, maybe I was. We'll get to that in a moment. But what were some of the specific actions I was taking and doing? I was sitting, right? I was sitting. I was working, something I needed to do. I was preparing. This is important to me. It's part of my job. It's important to others. I feel like others, you know, expect me to be prepared. I was watching people. I was looking, not wanting people to know, but I was looking over the top of my computer, observing people. So those are the basic things. Now, as I was doing these behaviors, these basic behaviors, how was I seeing those people who were walking by looking for seats? I mean, you could say I was looking at them as potential threats, right? I mean, they were going to invade my little bubble I'd created. They were even problems or nuisances, the way that I was behaving. And as you think about this, would you say that I considered those looking for a seat to have legitimate needs as I had in that moment? Probably not, right? I mean, I seemed to be operating like what I had to do was more important and everybody else's needs were secondary. So in that moment, my needs and desires seemed to trump, at least in my opinion, the needs and desires of everyone else who was walking in looking for a seat. I mean, they seemed to matter much less to me than my own needs in that moment. Now, compare this situation to another situation we had about a week and a half ago. My family and I were flying back from vacation, and we'd been on a long flight. And through the night, red-eye flight, got into Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, had about a 65, 70-minute layover. So we walked from the gate we got into, walked to our new gate. As we got there, it was an overbooked flight, so the gate was full. We grabbed some breakfast. There were virtually no seats. I mean, there's a seat here and a seat there in the waiting area. And so we just kind of walked up to the end of a row of seats. And, you know, we all have backpacks and all of our stuff that we're traveling with and all our carry-ons. And we, you know, just kind of plop it all down. And you know, as we put it down, I look up and there's a lady sitting in the seats in front of us, and she immediately makes eye contact with us, and she says, hey, would you guys be interested in our seats right here? I mean, we can move down and you guys could take our seats right here. Now, let's think about this woman for just a moment. How would you think that she saw us in that moment? All right, think about this for a moment. Did she see us as nuisances or problems or like a threat to her personal space? No. I mean, she just saw us as people looking for a place to sit, right? That's all she saw us as. Think about that for a moment. She just saw us as people. We're going to come back to that in just a moment. But first, I want us to kind of compare how this woman apparently saw others needing a place to land and how I was viewing people needing a place to land in that Starbucks a month and a half earlier. See, I saw myself as more important than everyone else looking for a space, right? I saw my needs greater in that moment. Whereas this woman, I mean, did she privilege her own needs and desires as more important than everybody else's, you know, in that environment? No, at least it didn't appear to be that way. So here we have two situations, right? Two people, I being one and this woman being the other, who each have empty seats next to them. Both of us are doing things important to us, right? We're traveling or we're working. I mean, she had a laptop or an iPad out on her lap. She was doing something while she was sitting there. We both have needs. We both have goals, aspirations, things we're trying to complete, places we're trying to go. We're both watching the people around us, right, in different ways. And yet, how does this woman's experience differ from mine? I mean, I minimize people in that moment, right? She didn't minimize people. I mean, I felt anxious and uptight. Every time somebody'd walk and kind of stall next to the seats around me, I'd kind of, oh, they're going to bother my area. I mean, you know, it's like a woman who walked up with two kids and they both had the crumb coffee cake. I'm like, that crap's going to end up all over my stuff. I mean, that's why I'm here, because I needed to get away from my kids, right? And there's another guy that walked in and he like knows everybody in Starbucks. I'm like, I don't need to be next to Mr. Talkative, right? I mean, it's not that I don't want to be social. I'm trying to hone in. So, I mean, I'm seeing everybody as a problem. And yet she on the other side, and I mean, blaming people, right? She didn't blame people. She didn't, you know, we had all kinds of stuff we were traveling with. She didn't look at all our stuff and our gaggle of kids and say, well, I'm not going to make space for them. She looked at us and said, hey, they are people with basic needs. They're just trying to find a seat. So here's the question. Isn't it true that both of these scenarios, there were just people who had basic needs? I mean, just simply trying to find a place to sit, People who had needs, challenges, goals, dreams, aspirations. And if that's true, then I've got a big problem, right? I mean, because that's not how I was seeing people that day. I was stressed and sitting in that coffee shop. In fact, when I was sitting in that coffee shop, my view of myself was superior to everybody else. I mean, I felt entitled. I mean, I was here first, so that entitles me to this space that I've created, this buffer around me. All right? I wasn't even seeing the people looking for a space as people. They were like threats. They were objects. They were just something to be conquered, to try to push away. I mean, notice how my view of myself and others in that moment was distorted from reality. I mean, the truth is, all of us are people. We're people with basic needs. We all have goals. We all have dreams. We all have challenges we're working through every day. We all have objectives we're trying to accomplish. But see, I didn't see it that way that day. And so my view of the world in that moment was systematically flawed in terms of how I was seeing others and how I was seeing myself. I mean, the lady who offered us her seat, you know, at the airport, she didn't see people that way. I mean, she just saw people clearly. I mean, she just saw people for who they were, with their needs, and straightforwardly. She was operating out of the box. I was operating in the box. So how do we get in the box? How do we get out of the box if we get in the box? And more importantly, how do we stay out of the box? And I'm not going to have a chance to dive into all of this today, but I want to give you another couple scenarios that will hopefully help you identify some scenarios in your life. You might go, oh my gosh, here's where I operate in the box. And then you can kind of get this book if you want to dive into it further. And so in the book Leadership and Self-Deception, there's kind of a scenario that I want to do my best to kind of portray to you today. I'm going to kind of give you a story that I've experienced from my life that kind of parallels this, and then give you a diagram that helps you kind of break down where you are in this, all right? And this story is one from our personal life. It's from our family life. You can take this application and you can apply it across the board to a business situation, in the office, a neighbor situation, whatever it is, or to your family. So when our 12-year-old daughter, Maggie, when she was an infant, that's when Crosspoint started. She's 12, Crosspoint's 12. She was born a month before first preview. That's how we know how old Crosspoint is and how old she is. They're both 12. And so it was a very stressful time in our lives, very intense time in our lives. Julie and I, we kind of had this rhythm when we had infants in our home. In the middle of the night feeding, when it was time for that feeding, I would get, you know, the baby up and I would change a diaper, his diaper, and, you know, change the onesie if that was needed. And then I'd get, you know, the child all ready and then take her to Julie in bed so Julie could feed her, because I couldn't do that. And then Julie would, you know, put her back down. It was a way I could, you know, we could both kind of participate in that. Well, one particular evening, Maggie woke up way earlier before the feeding time. It was earlier than normal, and she was wailing. And Maggie, you know, when Maggie wailed, everybody knew it, all right? I mean, the kids are like, make it stop. You know, I mean, it's just when Maggie's not happy, you know it. And so in that moment, I have a thought or an impression of something I should do for Julie. All right. In that moment, I thought, you know, I should get up. I should tend to Maggie so that Julie can continue to sleep. Right. And so remember, we're all people. We all have basic needs. We all have basic human needs. We all have things we're trying to do. And if I'm going to live outside of the box, I'm going to try to see others as people that just have basic human needs, challenges, objectives, things they're trying to get done. And so there are moments, as we learned from that video a moment ago, where in that moment we see something like, you know, I should do this. I feel impressed to do this right here for another person. It's not something someone asks. It's just a sense that I get of something I could do for someone else. And so in that moment, I felt the desire to do something for Julie, to tend to Maggie so she wouldn't be woken up and she could get her sleep, but I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I just stayed in bed and let Maggie cry. Now, in that moment, you could say I self-betrayed myself. Now, that's kind of a strong word, right? But as we heard in the video, self-betrayal is simply when we feel a sense or a nudge to do something, but we choose to do something to the contrary, all right? We don't do that thing for the other person. Now, this is one of the most common things in the world. Self-betrayal happens every single day. It's probably happened for you already this morning. Could have happened when you pulled into the parking lot. Maybe you pulled into the parking lot. You're getting ready to pull into a parking spot. Somebody coming the other way saw the same spot. You saw them. You're like, oh, I feel like I should let them have that spot. But you were kind of there first, and you're like, if I just look away from them and don't make eye contact, I can pull in, and they're not going to know any different, right? So you had a nudge to do something, but you chose to ignore it or not follow through on it. You had a moment of self-betrayal. Maybe it was when you were walking in the doors this morning. Maybe you were coming in and you saw a young mom or a young dad carrying three kids and diaper bags and they're trying to keep everybody corralled. And you're like, man, I should wait and hold the door for them. But oh my gosh, I'm late and I got to get my coffee before the line gets long. And so you didn't hold the door. You walked on in and they didn't know any different. But you knew in your mind that you didn't do the thing that you felt like you should do. Maybe it was a moment this week where you felt like you should spend some time with your child or spend some time with your spouse or your partner, whatever it is, but you didn't do it. Or maybe it was a moment this week when you said something, you're like, man, I really probably need to go back and apologize to that person. But you didn't. I mean, so it could be any number of things. These are all simple moments of self-betrayal, and it happens throughout the day. All right? It's just that moment where I feel like I should do something, I should act, and then I choose not to. So back to our crying baby. We got Maggie crying. I had a sense in that moment that I should get up and tend to Maggie so that Julie could continue to sleep. And in that moment, I had a choice to make. I'm either going to honor that sense or that nudge that I had, or I'm going to betray it, which is self-betrayal. So imagine for just a moment, all right, Julie's laying there, I'm laying there, all right, and in that moment, imagine what I may have began to feel about Julie after I made the decision not to get up. I felt this nudge. I should do this for her. It'd be good for me to do this. It'd be good for her. I'm not going to do it. So I stay there lying. Maggie's still crying, right? Imagine what I might begin to feel about Julie. All right, it'd be easy for me to begin as I'm laying there awake now to go, oh my gosh, Julie's not getting up. I mean, she is lazy. I mean, she's not getting up and doing this, right? And it's actually pretty inconsiderate of her not to get up. I mean, she probably hears the child, and so all of a sudden I'm feeling like she is, oh, my pen's not right. Inconsiderate. And, you know, I've got a big meeting tomorrow. You know, I'm kind of a big deal in the office. I mean, people are going to, you know, expect things from me. And if I don't get my sleep, I'm not going to be on my game. And, you know, and so, man, she is very unappreciative of what I do every day. I mean, obviously she'd get up if she knew what a big deal I was, right? And then she rolls over and kind of turns over the other way, right? And I look at her, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think she's been awake the whole time. She's faking sleeping. She is a faker, holy cow. She is totally faking this. She's been awake the whole time. You know what? Man, she is a lousy mom. Right? I mean, what mom fakes sleeping when her daughter's crying? I don't even know her. That's not the woman I married. She's a lousy wife, right? Now, look at this. Look at this list right here. I mean, So I betrayed myself, right? I had a sense. Nobody asked me to do anything. I just feel, oh, boy, it'd be helpful to Julie if I got up and, you know, quieted our child so she could continue sleeping. And then I choose not to follow through on it. And look at how I begin to think about my wife. She's just sitting there sleeping, right? She's lazy. She's, you know, inconsiderate. She's unappreciative. She's a faker. I think she's awake, all right? I mean, she's a lousy wife, lousy. I mean, that's terrible, right? I've like totally vilified the person I love the most, right? And she didn't even know it. Now, that's not the worst of it. It gets worse, all right? Now, let's think about this. Let's think about how I begin to see myself in that moment after I self-betray, all right? So how do you think I start seeing myself? I'm like, well, I happen to be the only one that woke up. So, I mean, man, I am a victim, right? I mean, I am totally a victim right here. And that begins to play out. And I'm like, you know, I do have this meeting tomorrow. And I mean, I do have to be on my game tomorrow. And I'm kind of important. I mean, I don't know that I need to be the one that, you know, that gets up every single time. I mean, I know she does it some, but, you know, I mean, I at least do 50% of the times in the middle of the night when she needs to be tended to. I mean, I do my fair share. I'm a pretty fair person, right? I mean, these are all the things as I'm laying there, I begin to think about myself. And before long, I think, well, you know, I bet every other dad in Fishers didn't get up and, you know, do that half the time. I am a good dad. That's what I am. I do at least 50% of the time, which makes me a good husband, right? Now, anybody been there? Anybody walked this path before? So here's what's so fascinating. When did this begin? It began the moment I chose not to follow through on something I just felt nudged to do. Nobody asked me to do it. I had a moment where I felt like I could do something for someone else. And once I betrayed myself, I began down this path. So let me kind of summarize what we're talking about right here. Self-betrayal is to act contrary to what I feel like I should do for one another. All right, so and after I've created that list, right? I mean, Julie, she's lazy and inconsiderate, and you know, I mean, I think she's faking this. I mean, do you think after I think all those things, I'm gonna go back and be like, you know what? I probably should just do the thing I felt like I should originally do. I should go to, am I gonna do that? No, because I feel like, I'm being violated now, right? So when I betray myself, I begin to see the world in a way that justifies my self-betrayal. When I self-betray, I have to then justify why I chose to do that. And I begin to have these thoughts and these feelings that tell me, you know, I'm justified to feel this way because of what I failed to follow through on. So number three, when I see the world in a self-justifying way, my view of reality, here's where it begins to get distorted, right? Now think about this. Before I betrayed myself, was there any tension between Julie and I? No, at least I wasn't aware of any. All right, it's just that all of a sudden my view got very distorted. What was our context? We were fine. We were just two people going to bed who had basic needs of sleep, you know, of trying to get up and work the next day. But in that moment, when I betrayed myself, I have to begin to justify, which begins to create tension. Number four, when I betray myself, I enter the box. What happens when I enter the box? I get a distorted view of reality. All right, because now I'm self-deceived, so even my solutions don't necessarily make the problem better. In fact, they make things worse for others because I'm operating out of a posture of being self-deceived. When I enter the box, I begin to inflate the faults of others, right? I mean, if my wife's all those things, if she's lazy and inconsiderate, and I mean, my word, that's going to make me angry, right? I'm angry now because she's all these things. She doesn't even know. She's been sleeping the whole time, right? And then when I get in the box, I begin to inflate my own personal virtues. Like how great I am. Well, this is why I shouldn't be the one to do this. And then I inflate the value of the things that justify my self-betrayal, which leads to blame. Whoa, how did I get there? Because self-deception is powerful. Very, very powerful. Now, just to be clear, was Julie to blame in any of this? No, right? She didn't do anything. She can sleep through the Indy 500, all right? Like our first year of marriage, we're like, you're done going to the 500. It's just a long nap for you, all right? It's an expensive nap. I mean, she can sleep through anything. She was never awake. This all happened as I'm there after I betrayed myself. Then I have to justify why I chose what I did. Was I irritated when we went to bed? No. When did I get irritated? Once I betrayed myself. And once I betrayed myself, then I have to justify. I get in the box, and once I'm in the box, my view is distorted, and I come up with solutions that aren't helpful to anyone. My word, are you seeing how powerful self-deception is? How it strikes at the core when Jesus says, treat others the way you want to be treated. Like, I think I do. Do you really? All right, we need to dig deep and say, okay, maybe we think it's always the other person. Maybe we think that if the other person could just get their deal figured out, that everything would be good, right? I'm telling you what, if this strikes a chord for you this morning, or if you've been having some ongoing tension in your marriage or tension at work or in a team or with leadership, whatever it might be, all right, maybe instead of looking out, we just have to look inward and ask ourselves the question, am I operating out of a self-betrayal mode? Am I self-deceived? Am I not seeing things clearly? Because see, here's the common denominator in all of your relationships. It's you. You ever thought about that? Common denominator in all of your relationships. It's you. Jesus says, I want you to treat others the way, the same way you want to be treated. And maybe, this starts with just simply seeing people as people. People with basic needs, challenges, desires, aspirations, goals, people just looking for a place to sit. You know, people just looking to provide for their family. I have to be honest, I've grown a lot in my EQ over the years, and it was, you know, even as we did these assessments, I realized I've grown so much, but, you know, this has challenged me because I'm like, man, I've got a lot more growth to do. and I can operate really well on this 10 times and then blow it 6 times in a row. The goal isn't becoming perfected, but it's continuing to become aware of where am I self-deceived and where am I betraying myself. And so I want to give us a few practical applications as we walk out, because if this hasn't landed with you, then man, I hope you come back next weekend, and it's going to be awesome as we kick off, you know, the brand new series with At the Movies. But if this has, I want to give you a couple walkouts. On the back of your connection card are some next steps. I encourage you to take that out or open it up in the app on your phone. And here's the first one I want you to think about. As you go about your week, I want to encourage you to get curious about the people around you, their needs, their challenges, their aspirations. You don't have to ask them. You can ask them. Just think, oh my gosh, why are they doing that? Well, they're just somebody like me trying to get through life, trying to make things work, all right? And remember that everyone around you is a person. And just see what happens. See what begins to change as you look at them this way. And if this has really struck a chord and you want to dig in deeper, I just really have scratched the surface on this whole idea. I encourage you to get the book, Leadership and Self-Deception. There's actually a button in the app where it'll take you right to Amazon where you can go ahead and purchase it right now. I'm not getting royalties off it, by the way. I mean, I have no connection to this other than it has been transformational for me over the last 2 weeks. I was going to teach on something else this weekend. I came in Monday. I'm like, oh, we got to change this. I've experienced something that totally fits Spark, and it's been a game changer for me. And so I encourage you to dive into it. I'm starting round 2 on the book this week. I mean, I've already read it once, and I'm going, I want to soak it in more because this changes leadership culture, family culture, marital culture, you know, everything relational. And so, you know, I just encourage you to say, okay, what does this mean for me? Well, one last thing, and this is more for those of us who maybe are here for the first time or we're back for the first time in a long time in church. Maybe we've had a distorted view of God. Maybe we've always seen God as this God who's out to get me, this God who just wants to strike me down or, you know, is trying to punish me. Have you ever asked yourself the question, why is it that that's how I view God? I mean, run God through the filter of this, what we just talked about this morning. See, is it possible that maybe you view God that way because that's how you view people? I mean, think about it. When Jesus got to that choice where Jesus, you know, knew he had to go to the cross, he had a choice to either honor what he felt he needed to do or to betray it. He chose to honor it. He followed through for you. See, if he would have self-betrayed, if he would have betrayed in that moment, then he would have come up with all the reasons why you didn't deserve it and all the reasons why you're a terrible person, you don't deserve to have grace. But he didn't. He didn't. He actually honored it because he sees people as people with just basic needs or trying to get through life and trying to figure out how to make, you know, life meaningful and abundant and live with joy and not out of fear. And that all comes as we, you know, understand that our Heavenly Father desires that for us. So maybe part of it for some of us is starting to change that posture and realize that God sees us differently. All right, I want to pray for us, and then we're going to sing one more song. Let's stand, let me pray for us, and then we'll get out of here in just a moment. Father, I thank you for this book, this Leadership and Self-Deception, this idea from Jesus of what it means to treat others the same way we want to be treated, and how this is really has challenged me over the last few weeks. And It's brought some new awareness of how I lead and how I can operate so well on this that I can totally blow it 10 times in a row. And God, as this lands for us this morning, as we're thinking about relationships or work situations, whatever it is, whatever applications we've made this morning, Father, I just pray that you'd help us to know what to do with what we've heard. There may be conversations we need to go have this week. There may be some follow-up we need to do. There may be some postures we need to change. Maybe it's just beginning to look more at ourselves instead of blaming others. Or what changes need to be made here instead of worrying about out there. So Father, I just pray that you'd help us know what to do with what we've heard. And God, for those of us who are maybe in need of a different posture of understanding who you are as a Heavenly Father, would you just direct us on that today? Would you prompt our hearts to maybe see where the outages have began? I just pray that you'd reveal yourself as a gracious, loving God who, when nudged, Jesus went to the cross for us, not because he had to, but because he saw us as people who were in need of being restored, of being rescued, of needed something that we could not do for ourselves, and that's available to every single one of us who want to receive it. So God, I pray that you help us be encouraged today. Not as we're running the filters, it'd be easy to walk out and go, oh my gosh, I've been failing at this. Help us to see that we don't have to live in the shame of that, that today is a new day and we can do things differently. So God, I just pray that you empower us as we go today, I pray.